Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline for the cover story, Sweet Dreams. Economics compel PNC Arena to reconfigure luxury suites to reach a broader corporate market. And that's the headline for it, but then the actual story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline, Thinking Inside the Box. PNC Arena revisits luxury suite layouts in effort to boost profitability. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun. The luxury boxes at PNC Arena have a problem. Too many sit empty. Sure, they'll sell out for big shows like Katy Perry or Justin Timberlake, but for Carolina Hurricanes or NC State Wolfpack games, as many as one-third of the 66 suites go unsold. Luxury boxes are really for companies only that can afford them, says Dave Olson, the general manager of Gale Force Holdings, which oversees the arena. In an attempt to generate revenue from those empty suites, which range in price from $80,000 to $150,000, the arena plans an experiment to renovate one of the boxes into a sort of semi-suite area, theater or loge, L-O-G-E box, in which individuals or companies can buy groupings of seats as part of a larger box that they share with others. Ideally, arena officials see it as a way to offer a mid-level option for smaller companies that want to have a VIP feel without paying the full cost of an entire luxury suite for the whole year. There is no question that the business model for suites has changed, says Jeff Merritt, executive director of the Centennial Authority, a politically appointed body that serves as the landlord of the arena. We don't have a lot of Fortune 500 companies that are headquartered here, but the business community does support this arena. Now, the arena wants to give those mid-level businesses a semi-luxury option. Think of it almost as a suite timeshare. Executives of a company with a few million dollars in revenue can buy four seats at a price well below what it would cost for the full box, but still have access to luxury features such as a private bar, food, and restrooms. Plans show the Loge box will have 30 seats, sold in four-seat or six-seat sets. The proposed price per seat for a season of hockey and basketball games will be $12,500, with an additional cost of food and beverage of $1,860 per seat. For the six seats, that comes to an annual cost of $75,000, and if all sell out, would mean $375,000 of total projected revenue for the arena. In addition, the arena would sell those seats for $1,875 per seat for the roughly 25 other events held at the arena, including concerts and other shows. Add in another $750 per seat for food and beverage, and the arena projects another $56,250 of revenue from those events. A national trend. Renovating suites into these Loge boxes is not uncommon in major arenas across the country. No good idea goes unstolen in the arena biz, quips Merritt. In the mid-2000s, Congress changed lobbying laws so that elected officials were required to pay their own way if they wanted to attend a game with a lobbying group. That affected Washington, D.C. the most, but also teams in various state capitals. Then, of course, the Great Recession hit, and companies everywhere cut back spending. That really took the wind out of the sails, Merritt says. Arenas around the nation have had success with the new Loge-style box, with varying terms and some including food and beverage or parking as well. The Verizon Center in Washington, D.C. has shown success with packages for either six or eight seats selling for between $131,000 and $157,000. In 2011, the Phoenix Suns converted eight suites to 16 theater boxes, which include four private restrooms and elevator access, 14 big-screen TVs throughout the lounge area, and a fully stocked bar, just to name a few of the extra amenities. These boxes are 100% leased for three-year terms at annual prices ranging from $30,000 to $40,000. The United Center in Los Angeles introduced 32 theater boxes in 2009. and the Bradley Center in Milwaukee followed suit in 2010, according to the Sports Business Journal, a sister publication. What's next? Before the arena jumps in with both feet and renovates all of the empty boxes, something that would cost in excess of $2 million, the Centennial Authority wants to try out an experiment with one box to sort of test the waters. Some on the authority remember a few years ago when it spent more than $1 million on suite renovations that resulted in very little additional interest. The authority has not given the final go-ahead, but is expected to authorize $90,000 to combine suites 127A and 127B into one loge area. Again, the seats in the front of the box will be designated for the ticket holder, with the suite area behind those seats open to all ticket holders in that 127 section. My support is cautiously optimistic that this reconfiguration will be a good product for the Hurricanes to sell, says Perry Safran, an authority member and founding partner of the Safran Law Offices in Raleigh. In some ways, the arena got lucky that 127 has been empty. It's directly behind the goal on the side where the Hurricanes shoot twice, and on the opposite end of where concerts set up the main stage, making it a more desired box location. Of course, all parties involved would rather all the suites had been sold and not have to make this switch. This is really a test to see if it works, Merritt says. And there's an accompanying story with this cover story, and it's headlined, Arena to Add LED Lighting. While PNC Arena executives will step cautiously into the Logue box plan, they will jump in with both feet when it comes to new lighting. The Centennial Authority, the group that acts as the landlord of PNC Arena, on May 21 approved a project to replace the bowl lights for the arena, those that light up the playing surface for basketball and hockey games. It's a move that modernizes the arena as well, as the new lights will be LED, light-emitting diode, which come with significant energy savings. With the current setup, annual energy costs for the lighting come to more than $56,000, mostly for hockey. The new system would come with annual energy costs of close to $15,000, or nearly 75% reduction. It says a lot of things. It says we are thinking green, says Dave Olson, general manager of the arena. There are so many reasons to do this, it's time to make the change. Work will begin soon, so crews have time to install all the lights during the off-season. Ideally, the lights will be fully installed so when players return for preseason workouts, crews can adjust light angles as needed to provide the best ice coverage before any games are actually played. Musco Sports Lighting was awarded a $650,000 contract for the work, and Centennial Authority Executive Director Jeff Merritt said the upgrade should improve viewing not only for fans in the arena, but also for television cameras. It's new technology that's proven itself and is more efficient, Merritt said. Light for fans in the arena and for the TV cameras just improves when you put in LED. The total energy bill for the arena comes to about $2.1 million per year, though that obviously includes massive costs to keep the ice cold. And finally, we have a couple of sections on the side of the article with more detailed information. First, by the numbers. Although PNC Arena marketing staff has not set prices in stone, listed below are the proposed terms for the new Logue boxes. They would be sold in either 4 or 6 seat groupings with separate pricing tiers for hockey and basketball games and for other events like concerts or the circus. Annual lease for hockey and basketball only? 30. Number of seats per Logue box? $12,500. The price per seat? $1,860. Cost of food and beverage per seat, $75,000, income annual lease. Annual rentals for other events, 30, number of seats per Logue box, $1,875, the price per seat, $750, cost of food and beverage per seat, $11,250, income annual lease. And in the closer look section, The Logue Boxes program would include an all-inclusive chef's choice calculated at $30 per ticket to include 3 cold food items, one being a salad, 4 hot food items, coffee station, non-alcoholic beverage, 2 beer or wine vouchers. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column, a quick glance at Triangle happenings, written by managing editor Rebecca Troyer. First, an editor's note. Last week, Governor Pat McCrory proposed a $21 billion state budget, a 1.7% increase over what the General Assembly originally passed for this fiscal year, which runs July 1 through June 30. As a special feature this week, Biz offers a roundup of the topics likely to produce lively debate in the upcoming session, along with a sampling of Twitter comments on the issues. First, we have economic development. Local privilege taxes may see caps. A proposed cap of privilege licenses is up for debate that would limit the amount of money that North Carolina cities and towns could charge businesses. The bill would set a flat $100 tax per business and would be effective in 2015. Fiscal analysts for the General Assembly estimate the proposed change could result in a net revenue loss of between $11.4 million and $25.2 million for North Carolina municipalities. But it would also standardize the privilege tax for all businesses, regardless of size. New Echo Devo structure on tap. The future of the proposed North Carolina Economic Development Partnership is also up for debate, which would restructure the North Carolina Department of Commerce and move most of its marketing and economic development recruitment duties to the nonprofit organization. Part of its purpose would be to give the state a vehicle in which to more freely negotiate with companies that are considering expansion or relocating in North Carolina without compromising the state's open records laws. The partnership would be funded by a mix of state funds transferred from the commerce budget and a minimum $10 million contribution from private sources from across the state. Education. Teacher pay top state agenda. No single portion of Governor Pat McCrory's proposed budget adjustments received as much attention as education. State taxpayers give a combined $11.6 billion to the UNC system, community colleges, and K-12 public schools, or more than half of the entire state budget. McCrory has been vocal in his intent to give public school teachers a starting salary wage increase of 7% to $33,000 per year, something that would add about $102 million to the $8.1 billion that the state gives the public schools. To offset some of that, McCrory proposed to reduce spending on the universities from $2.6 billion they were set to receive this coming year to $2.55 billion instead, a 2% reduction. UNC System President Tom Ross pushed back against this proposal, pointing out that the state already spends nearly $1,000 less per full-time equivalent student than it did in 2007 to 2008. This budget would make it increasingly hard for UNC campuses to recruit and retain the best and most accomplished faculty as well as staff, Ross said. In response, Ryan Tronovich, Deputy Communications Director in the Governor's Office, said, "There are efficiencies that need to be made in our university system in order to be affordable and effective, both for the students and the taxpayers." North Carolina film incentives. Filmmaker credits up for debate. North Carolina's governor recently remarked he would like to see changes to the state's film incentive program. Although the specifics haven't been detailed yet, during a recent press conference on his proposed budget, Governor Pat McCrory said he wants to see legislators encourage capital investment in long-term studios to take the place of TV and film crews coming to the state for brief amounts of times, using money that could have gone to teachers. The current structure of the film incentive, which is set to end in 2015, is a 25% tax credit. The year before the incentive went into place, state documents show that film production spent $1.5 million in the state and created 16 jobs. A year after the incentive was put in place, the numbers jumped to $117 million spent in the state by film productions and 8,833 jobs created. Numbers dropped sharply in 2010, but thanks to the filming of Iron Man 3 and The Hunger Games, about 20,000 jobs were created by the film industry in 2012. Entrepreneurship. Budget could boost university startups. Governor McCrory's proposed budget includes $3 million annually to help transition university research to the commercial marketplace. A new addition this year, the item was part of the UNC system's budget recommendations and is intended to provide for competitive funding for proof-of-concept work, commercialization costs, and additional capacity to assess, protect, develop, and commercialize intellectual property. Terry Lomax, Vice Chancellor of the Office of Research, Innovation, and Economic Development at NC State University, says it's a move that will help all universities. If we're going to have increased funding, that will help move the discoveries out to where they can benefit society, she says. McCrory also includes $2 million in new funding for the NCSU-based Extension Generation Power Electronics Innovation Institute, part of a five-year, $10 million state commitment. And finally, we have the tweets of the week. Twitterati weigh in on the budget. At Pat McCrory NC, budget to revise film incentive program with details coming. Welfare for Hollywood big business is not good business for NC. Hashtag NCGA. And that's from Sean at Sean C 2008. Industry comment. Economic and workforce development partnership best in North Carolina of any state I've seen, but still challenges. And that's from Scott Rawls. And hashtag ED Forum 14, Lyndon Muth, we take technology for granted, by rural areas may not have technology we considered standard in urban areas. At Morrisville, NC. And now we turn to the A Better World section in the Triangle Business Journal. First, we read the column of Todd Cohen, and the headline on the column, Lawyer Works to Prevent Violence. Nearly one in four college women in the U.S. have either been raped or suffered an attempted rape. Just this month, the U.S. Department of Education released the names of 55 colleges and universities, including Guilford College in Greensboro and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, that are under investigation for their handling of sexual assault complaints. Charles R. Ullman, a family lawyer in Raleigh who sees a lot of clients who are victims of sexual assault and domestic violence, is trying to raise awareness on college campuses about the issue and to raise money and in-kind support for nonprofits that support victims. In my daily work, I have seen the harms wrought by domestic violence and wanted to find a way to reduce the number of victims, Ullman says. Earlier this year, Ullman asked ConsultWebs, a Raleigh-based web marketing group for law firms that designed its website, to develop a charitable initiative for him. Marjorie Marr, a consultant at the firm, worked with Ullman to develop Fraternities for Family, an effort that recruits fraternities on campuses to educate their peers about sexual assault and domestic violence, and to raise support for local nonprofits that provide services and shelter to victims. Marr contacted campus interfraternal groups, which suggested campus fraternities that might be interested in participating. She enlisted one fraternity at each of the five schools, Duke University, Elizabeth City State University, Elon University, North Carolina State University, and Winston-Salem State University. She also invited five domestic violence nonprofits to participate and paired each fraternity with a nonprofit. Consult Webbs and Ullman created a webpage for Fraternities for Family. On the website of Charles R. Ullman and Associates, and individual pages for each fraternity, as well as pages with information about domestic violence in North Carolina and about domestic violence resources for students. Phi Gamma Delta Fraternity at NCSU collected 6,100 items, from cleaning products and linens to food and baby formula, worth an estimated $25,000, and donated it to the Durham Crisis Response Center. When we get those types of donations, especially at that scale, we don't have to go out and purchase those things, says Tammy Donald, Director of Marketing and Project Development at the nonprofit. Ullman and members of the fraternity donated another $1,000, and four fraternity members volunteered 12 hours each at the agency's golf event at Crossings in Durham in April, which raised another $25,000. And the fraternity is sponsoring an event on May 20 at Gregoria's Restaurant in Durham to raise money for a building fund at the agency to expand its 17-bed shelter. At Duke, Phi Delta Theta hosted an event in April at Divine Grill and Sports in Durham that raised $1,000 for Families Living Violence Free, a nonprofit in Oxford. Fraternities for Family already has signed up fraternities at 10 more schools to participate next year, Ullman says. I believe that men are essential to ending this type of violence, he says. That's why I decided to work with fraternities. And in nonprofit news, donations help hemophilia patients. Biogenidec, which has two major operations in the Triangle, along with Swedish Orphan Biovitrum AB, will donate 1 billion units of clotting factor therapy for humanitarian aid programs in the developing world. This donation is expected to enable a predictable, sustainable humanitarian supply of factor therapy and improve the quality of patient care and outcomes in the developing world. Hemophilia is a rare chronic inherited disorder in which the ability of a person's blood to clot is impaired. This can lead to recurrent and extended bleeding episodes. An estimated 400,000 people worldwide are living with hemophilia, and of these, more than 300,000 individuals live in areas where there is limited access to diagnosis and treatment. Lenovo donates tablets for youth. The first tee of the Triangle received 10 free yoga tablet computers that will provide students with access to top-of-the-line technology designed to support a new STEM component to the first tee curriculum. The donation is made possible through the Lenovo North America PC Plus Doers for Youth Employee Volunteer Grant Program, which allows employees the opportunity to submit one PC Plus grant application for an eligible charity after logging a minimum of 40 volunteer hours in a single fiscal year. And now we turn to the reporter pages in the Triangle Business Journal. First, we have the page of Amanda Hoyle, who covers commercial and residential real estate. Her main article is headlined, Raleigh to Rezone 34,000 Parcels, Commercial Property Owners Should Watch for Postcards. Raleigh city leaders are sending out 45,534 postcards to the owners and neighbors of some 34,000 property parcels that will be impacted by the city's new zoning district laws. About 30% of Raleigh's land area will be affected by the zoning changes. The new zoning district designations, which dictate what can and can't be built on a particular property, will officially take effect when the city council votes on the proposal later this year, but the public comment period ends September 30. My first piece of advice to property owners is pay attention to this, says Lacey Reeves, a land use attorney with the Smith Anderson Law Firm in Raleigh. It is very important that property owners read and try to understand what zoning changes are being made to their property. The city's new zoning district remapping project is the cherry on top of all of the work that Raleigh planning staff and commission members have been working toward the last few years following the adoption of the new comprehensive plan and the new land development regulations under the Unified Development Ordinance. Each postcard will identify the parcel to which it relates and inform the owner of the new zoning district proposed for that parcel. Postcards will also be mailed to the owners of all parcels within 100 feet of each property for which a zoning change is proposed. Most of the affected properties will be matched up with new zoning designations that most closely resemble the previous zoning designation, but some zoning districts will have conditions and restrictions that may impact existing businesses, Reeve says. The zoning district remapping project does not affect owners of low-density residential properties, such as traditional single-family neighborhoods. The city has set up a website, www.raleighudo.us, and a phone hotline that went live May 19 with staff trained to answer questions and offer details and information about the new zoning laws and requirements. And we have two smaller sections on this page. The first section is residential market. To buy or to rent? That's the question. Deutsche Bank, in collaboration with the Wall Street Journal, has released a report that did the math for us on whether or not it is cheaper to buy a home or to rent an apartment. By calculating the cost for the average monthly rent as a percentage of the estimated monthly mortgage payment for a home, the report showed that it could be cheaper to rent in Raleigh, but more expensive to rent and cheaper to buy a home in Charlotte or Greensboro. Cheaper to buy? 121% Greensboro, 108% Charlotte. Cheaper to rent? 94% Raleigh. The next section, Property Matters. New Wade office building plan near PNC Arena. The new owners of the Wade Office Park near PNC Arena in West Raleigh have announced plans to begin construction of Wade 3 as early as this summer, the first new office building in the park in 6 years. The Wade 3 building is stated to be a four-story, 105,000-square-foot office building that will be built to LEED Gold certification standards. The Avison Young commercial real estate firm will be its first tenant, with plans to relocate and occupy 12,000 square feet when it opens. The Wade 1 and Wade 2 office buildings both opened in 2008 and have a combined 194,558 square feet of office space. The buildings were 89% occupied as of the end of the first quarter. The next reporter page is that of Jason DeBrun, who covers healthcare and biopharmaceuticals. The headline on the main story, Chimerix to sell shares. Durham company needs funds to finance drug trial for Josh Hardy. In part to fund a drug trial initiated because of public pressure, Durham's Chimerix will sell 6.2 million shares in hopes of raising at least $60 million. In filings made after the stock market closed on May 19, Chimerix announced it would sell the additional shares in part to fund a clinical trial to test its lead drug candidate, brincidofovir, on treating an adenovirus infection. Chimerix had focused its development of brincidofovir on treating double-stranded DNA viral infections, including cytomegalovirus and adenovirus common in transplant patients. That focus partly shifted earlier this year after an aggressive social media campaign led by the family of Josh Hardy, a 7-year-old cancer survivor who suffered from an adenovirus infection. His family asked Chimerix for brincidofovir for the young boy, but was first denied because the drug was not yet approved in the U.S. or by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Chimerix had denied other requests for the drug as well, but the Hardy family's savvy social media campaign was picked up by national media outlets, leading to an outcry and death threats made to former CEO Ken Moak, who eventually resigned. Although Chimerix never officially tied the resignation to the Hardy case, the two events happened around the same time. Drug companies are allowed what is called a compassionate use program, in which under special circumstances, they may provide a drug to a person before the FDA has approved that drug. Chimerix had such a program but closed it more than a year ago to finish out development and seek FDA approval so the drug could be used widely. Instead, under public pressure, Chimerix opened a new drug trial to test brincidofovir, with Hardy the first to enroll. Until May 19, Chimerix executives had not revealed the study's costs. The announcement that Chimerix plans to raise $60 million does not single out the adenovirus study as the sole reason, but lists it along with a planned clinical trial for brincidofovir in kidney transplant patients and other potential studies of the drug as reasons to sell the additional shares. Now that Chimerix has initiated the process to sell additional shares, underwriters will test the market. Timing and share price of the new offering could affect how much Chimerix raises by millions of dollars. In the initial filing, Chimerix did not release an estimated share price. Shares fell 15% on May 20 to nearly $14, near the low end of the 52-week range of $12.96 to $27.69. The announcement was made after market closed. The share price did not change in aftermarket trading. As of March 31, Chimerix had $37 million of cash and equivalents and $63 million in short-term investments available for sale. And on this page, we also have a hospital update section. Hospitals provide millions in free care. Hospitals often tout how much in charity care they provide, that being healthcare services they give to the poor and indigent or elderly for which they are not reimbursed. Combined, the Triangle's hospitals provided a community benefit valued at more than $850 million in 2013, according to data recently updated by the North Carolina Hospital Association, which tracks community benefit reports from hospitals throughout the state. Total community benefit includes more than simply charity or uncompensated care, which is health care provided by a hospital for which that the hospital never sees payment. The entire community benefit figure includes adjustment for losses from treating Medicare and Medicaid patients. And listed below are the Triangle hospitals ranked by total community benefit and charity care alone. Total community benefits includes charity care. Duke University Hospital, $256 million. Wake Med Raleigh, $234 million. UNC Hospitals, $161 million. Rex Healthcare, $90 million, part of UNC Healthcare. Duke Regional, $55 million, part of DUHS. Duke Raleigh, $49 million. Johnston Memorial, $18 million. Charity care only. Wake Med Raleigh, $81 million. UNC Hospitals, $53 million. Duke University Hospital, $45 million. Rex Healthcare, $29 million, part of UNC Healthcare. Duke Regional, $20 million, part of DUHS. Duke Raleigh, $13 million. And Johnston Memorial, $10 million. And next we have the reporter page for Lauren Onsorge, who covers technology and entrepreneurship. Her main article has the headline, Cell Sorting for Life. And that's cell, C-E-L-L. Duke's breakthrough could keep cancer in remission. A research team with a global reach has developed a chip-like device that could make cancer remission permanent. And that's just the start. It's like a random access memory chip, but instead of electrons, there are moving cells. That's according to Duke University researcher Benjamin Yellen, an associate professor of mechanical engineering and materials sciences and lead on the project. Yellen, along with other researchers at both Duke University and Daegu Gyeongbuk Institute of Science and Technology in South Korea, say their cell sorting system will revolutionize research. Says Yellen, "What we are doing is very similar to how a computer works. You have an array of memory sites, and you can write data to the memory by adding an electron. In this case, his team is trying to develop an array of cells that can be controlled with magnetic fields. Scientists could then observe individual cells and how they respond to treatments. To do it, Yellen and his fellow researchers have printed thin electromagnetic components similar to what's found on microchips onto a slide. The patterns create magnetic tracks and elements like switches, transistors, and diodes that guide magnetic beads and single cells tagged with nanoparticles through a thin liquid film. The result? An integrated circuit that controls cells with magnetism. Single-cell analysis is becoming increasingly important, Yellen says. A lot of times when we're looking for a needle in a haystack, when we try to analyze tissue, the result is we miss it because we are analyzing thousands of cells, grinding them up, putting them in a tube. He uses cancer as one possible application. Typically, when people go into remission, this is where your cancer essentially goes to sleep, he says. Chemotherapy has already killed most of the actively dividing cancer cells, but the ones that are asleep are not killed by the chemotherapy. They lay dormant. Yellen's research could help scientists identify these sleeping cancer cells and understand which genes are being turned on or off. The ultimate goal is to figure out how to keep those cells dormant or even to wake them up so they can be killed. The applications don't stop there. Yellen tells me he has recently received a grant to apply the science to HIV research. Currently, when researchers study cells, they grind up a group of cells and analyze genetic activity by averaging the population of the entire tissue, rather than looking at differences cell by cell. That's like taking the eye color of everyone in a room and finding that the average color is gray, when not a single person in the room has gray eyes. You need to be able to study individual cells to understand and appreciate small but significant differences in a similar population. Researchers plan to demonstrate a larger grid for analyzing more cells. If it's successful, the technique could be manufactured, giving scientists around the world access to a new single-cell experimentation tool. And we have two more sections on this page. First, they said it. Be sure to know what your objective is and who your target audience is. That's from Teresa Chu, co-founder of Durham dog treat startup Barley Labs, speaking after the premiere of her company's brand new commercial with advice to those looking to make spots of their own. With enough data combined with the right analytics, you can zoom all the way out to witness what goes on in an entire planet. That's from Bob Greenberg, site lead for IBM at Research Triangle Park, telling the crowd at NCTA's State of Technology event that IBM's new strategy is all about data. And finally, by the numbers, Bootsuite, a marketing optimization startup and brainchild of iContact founder Aaron Houghton, surveyed the content marketing efforts of more than 16,000 small companies, and this is what the team found. 81% of small business marketers create different content for web versus social versus email newsletters. 74% of small business marketers have never traded content with an online partner. 86% of small businesses don't use data to guide their content marketing efforts. And now we have the reporter page of Dawn Curry, who covers small business, personalities, and triangle trends. And the main article has the headline, Local Farm to Expand Cheese Operation. The recent Beard Foundation Awards dinner had something local on the menu, Hunkadora, a goat cheese made in Rougemont outside of Durham. The cheese comes from Prodigal Farm, the only animal welfare-approved dairy farm in the States, besides the Chapel Hill Creamery. The farm has about 350 goats, of which 80 are milking goats. While the cheeses are sold around the country, the owners of the farm want to expand and are taking it one step at a time. On May 18, their Kickstarter campaign closed out, totally funded with $45,621. Farm co-owner Catherine Spann says she wasn't expecting it to happen so soon, when the goal was met several hours early. This money will allow the farm to add a cheese aging cave and will aid in preparing for the first phases of farm expansion. Amazingly, just a few weeks ago, we were also contacted by a landowner just up the road who has been leasing her 260-plus acre farm to more conventional commodity farmers, Spann says. She's become increasingly concerned about the effects of the chemical inputs on the farm and reached out to us to farm it with a multi-year phase-in. There are already old, out-of-use houses on the land, which can be converted to a cow milking house and a farm manager house. It immediately sets us up to move to the cow phase. The farm opens up a few times a year for free public tours, during which visitors learn about the work-intensive milking process, get to see the cheese-making stations, and learn the history behind the name Hunkadora, which was originally the name of the town Bahama. The farm owners will begin mapping out pasture land to decide how many cows to buy, and will be moving towards creating mixed milk cheeses, which include milk from goats and cows. And the next article has a headline, Full Moon Oyster Bar to open in Morrisville. The Full Moon Oyster Bar and Seafood Restaurant, with locations in Clemens and Southern Pines, is coming to Morrisville. But that's not all. Company President Randy Russell says plans are underway to establish a fourth location in Jamestown. Both locations are awaiting permits, but sites have been selected and investors are on hand with funds to support the endeavors. Russell spent years selling seafood to local restaurants around the Triangle for Fresh Catch Seafood Incorporated, a seafood wholesaler in Durham, and ultimately decided to open a restaurant himself. He's passionate about seafood and the ocean and says his wife is too. "We just love being on the water," Russell says. "Last year for her birthday, my wife said, 'Take me fishing,' so that's what we did." The restaurants don't have tables. Instead, a long bar snakes around the inside of the dining area, and shuckers serve you from behind the bar. Often live music accompanies your dinner. "You come as a stranger and leave as a friend," he says. "You're sitting next to someone who's looking at what you're eating, and you're looking at what they're eating, and they might say, 'You want a bite?'" Russell says a separate company is formed for each restaurant, guided by original members of the first Clemens site opened 11 years ago. He says he hopes to hire around 24 employees at the Morrisville location. And we have one section along the side of this page, RDU update. Finding a seat in RDU's Terminal 1. A recent outcry over Raleigh-Durham International Airport's newly renovated Terminal 1 being crowded has been eased with the addition of 200 seats in the concourse. ABC 11 aired footage last week of passengers seated on floors, not an uncommon sight in any airport, but said it suggested a lack of seating after the terminal's major overhaul. After the subsequent installation of 200 seats in the terminal, the total chair count comes to 578 available sitting spaces. Currently, the terminal is accommodating 30 arrival and departure flights a day, with Southwest Airlines and AirTran flights arriving at and departing from the terminal. Last year, the airport saw 2.2 million passengers come and go. And now we turn to a business profile of Madison Energy Group. And the headline, an idea best kept in the freezer. Madison Energy makes cold food storage more efficient, less costly. And this article is written by Dawn Curry. With nothing but a mattress on the floor and cold water showers at his rented townhouse that was in foreclosure, Will Geist knew he had to reinvent himself. His private equity firm, Madison Diversified, had just crashed along with the economy, but he wasn't about to give up. The young entrepreneur decided to draw upon his experience at his first job at McDonald's to find a way to change the food service industry. Today, the CEO of Raleigh-based Madison Energy Group is leading a company that, after 3 years in business, generated $12 million in annual revenue in 2013 and is expanding across the globe. With a team of engineers and an understanding of how restaurants store food, Geist and his partners came up with a non-electronic device that they say is cutting restaurants' energy bills by as much as 30%. It's really simple, he says. The temperature of food doesn't change the way the temperature of air does. I thought about the inefficiency of walk-in coolers and freezers. You have this place where everything is frozen right next to a hot kitchen. Every time the door is opened and the hot air hits the thermostat, the generator kicks in. His product, the Energy 2, is a small box that Guy says is the size of a Samsung Galaxy Note and contains a dense gel that simulates any changes in food temperature. The box is placed over the thermostat's probe inside the cooler, so it's reacting to what it's supposed to be reacting to. At the end of the day, essentially, what we're doing is eliminating the unnecessary cycles in electricity, he says. The product took a year to design, and Geist raised $50,000 from Chapel Hill investment firm Trion Capital Investments for development and production. The Energy 2 is made in Atlanta and sells for $599. The Madison Energy Group's first big client was the McDonald's franchise of South Carolina. And Guy says he was thankful to start a partnership with the former franchisee board chair, who introduced Guy to upper-level executives in the McDonald's Corporation. An introduction, Guy said, was intimidating. The 32-year-old CEO has since seen his product introduced in Rainforest Cafes, the Angus Barn, and Rex Healthcare, as well as hotels and restaurants in the Caribbean, Mexico, Canada, and Scandinavia. The company is running a pilot program with Kroger, and by summer, Geist hopes to expand sales into Germany, the Middle East, Panama, and Colombia. And along with this article, there's a small box headlined Closer Look. Company, Madison Energy Group. Headquarters, Raleigh. Year founded, 2010. Number of employees, 3 full-time plus 124 contracted sales representatives. Annual revenue, $12 million. And now we turn to the People on the Move section in the Triangle Business Journal. The spotlight in this issue is on Julie Earp, managing partner of Smith Moore Leatherwood. Julie Earp, who joined the law firm of Smith Moore Leatherwood after graduating from the University of Georgia School of Law in the late 1980s, has been named the firm's first female managing partner. She succeeds Rob Marcus, who will resume his commercial litigation practice after serving in the MP role for the past 4 years. In her new role, Earp now leads the firm's management committee, responsible for ensuring that its clients are well served and that its lawyers have what they need to provide that service. Smith Moore Leatherwood employs 173 attorneys and 191 staff members in its 7 offices, located in Greensboro, Raleigh, Charlotte, and Wilmington, Greenville and Charleston, South Carolina, and Atlanta, Georgia. What are some of your major goals in this position? To be sure, we think proactively and creatively about ways to continue to meet our clients' legal needs in effective and efficient ways. Biggest pet peeve? People who externalize fault as a substitute for recognizing responsibility. Biggest challenge? The biggest challenge for law firms today is recognizing that the old way of doing things is not always the best way. Triangle business person you most admire? Jim Goodnight, CEO of SAS Institute. He puts his people first and the rest follows. Personal, married to Steve Earp, a partner at Smith Moore Leatherwood. 5 children, Tom, Amanda, Kate, Megan, and Anna. 1 grandchild, James. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal. And we have a guest column. The guest column is written by Alan Fryer, who is a policy analyst for the Budget and Tax Center at the North Carolina Justice Center in Raleigh. The headline on his guest column, his viewpoint, North Carolina's incentives bypass rural areas. North Carolina has big problems in many of its small places, and the way the state spends money on incentives isn't helping matters. In the past 5 years, the state's major incentive programs have overwhelmingly favored wealthy urban areas like Greater Charlotte and the Triangle at the expense of the state's economically distressed rural areas. While business incentives should not be the state's only strategy for creating jobs in rural North Carolina, good roads, schools, and workforce training programs are always more effective. Providing public subsidies to support private sector job creation are likely to remain in the state's economic development toolbox. Given this reality, lawmakers should overhaul these programs to make sure that rural and more impoverished regions of the state aren't left behind. The state has five major incentive programs originally created to target business development resources to economically distressed and rural areas: the 1NC Fund, the Job Development Investment Grant, JDIG, the Jobs Maintenance and Capital Fund, JMAC, the Industrial Development Fund, IDF, and the IDF Utility Account. A quick look at where the incentive programs have spent their money over the past 5 years shows just how much these programs have fallen short of their promise. These programs invested overwhelmingly more in the state's 20 wealthiest counties, designated Tier 3 counties by the Department of Commerce, most of which are urban, than in the poorest 40 counties designated Tier 1, all of which are rural. Since 2007, the state has awarded more than triple the amount of incentive dollars to projects in the wealthiest 20 counties than projects in the state's 40 most distressed counties. 7 out of every $10 went to the counties that needed help the least. The state's incentive projects promise to create or retain 2 jobs in the wealthiest counties in the state for every 1 job promised to the poorest counties. Given that the distressed Tier 1 counties are the most in need of jobs, effectively targeted incentive programs would attempt to deliver more jobs to these counties than to the wealthier Tier 3 counties. Yet the state did the opposite, implementing incentives that promised to create almost 90,000 jobs in the state's least distressed counties, almost double the 42,235 jobs promised to the most distressed Tier 1 counties. Just 3 counties account for more than 56% of the total incentive dollars granted statewide since 2007: Mecklenburg, Durham, and Wake. Mecklenburg alone received more than a third, $303 million, of the entire $840 million granted across the state in the last 5 years. This was largely due to a single project, the $100 million MetLife deal signed last year. Given this startling mismatch, the state needs to spend less money on incentives in the most prosperous metros in the state and start investing more in the roads, schools, and job training programs most likely to create jobs in the state's most distressed and rural communities. Lawmakers can start by making some smart reforms. First, stop offering 1NC awards as part of joint projects in wealthy counties. Too often, the state has used 1NC to sweeten the deal for projects in the counties that least need deal sweeteners. As a result, the state ends up paying more money for the same number of jobs promised by these projects, while increasing the amount of money spent on incentives in wealthy counties compared to the poorer counties. If policymakers want to address these disparities, they must stop offering 1NC awards alongside JDIG projects in the wealthy urban counties. Secondly, change the formula for awarding JDIG dollars based on capital investment requirements to bring the return on investment back in line with the 1NC program. JDIG projects cost 20 times as much per project as 1NC, but get only minimally greater return on investment in terms of job creation. Making this change would result in spending less per project and per job in Tier 3 counties than is spent now. Fixing the disparities in economic development investments between urban and rural counties is relatively straightforward. It's not so much that the state should spend more on incentives in rural communities, it's that the state should reform the design and implementation of its existing programs to spend less on incentives in wealthier urban counties. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read as much as we can of the next guest column headlined, Keep Amateurism in College Sports. This is written by Ben Sutton, who is president of IMG College in Winston-Salem, a collegiate marketing agency. By nearly every conceivable metric, college sports continue to grow. The Northwestern University football team recently gained approval from the National Labor Relations Board to be treated as a labor union, in effect turning student-athletes into university employees. Make no mistake, student-athletes' hard work and commitment absolutely benefit schools, which generate revenue and bigger donations while building their brands. Student-athletes also get a lot in return, an invaluable education at prestigious institutions. It's a consensual, symbiotic relationship between schools and student-athletes in which everyone benefits. Students who want a salary for their athletic prowess or who simply do not want a college education should be allowed to take a separate path and play professional sports. Discarding the amateurism model will trigger a powerful chain reaction, unintended consequences sure to affect schools' Olympic and non-revenue-producing sports, and roll back Title IX gains, depriving thousands of young people a college education. Revenue from college sports is our country's single greatest source of college scholarships, next to the federal government. If the amateur model is blown up, other vexing questions come into play, including the virtual impossibility of determining who gets paid what. Is it by performance, position, recruit versus walk-on? The rapid growth of intercollegiate athletics has put more demands on student-athletes. Reforms must be undertaken to ensure the players' well-being, including full and appropriate care when injured. Changes to cover student-athletes' full cost of attendance are a good start. And we're going to start there as we have run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.